Welcome to the Go Well program, Dr. Ben Milbourne.
Hi, Kate. Nice to meet you today.
Look, I came across your a media release from Curtin University in WA on coding clubs to help adolescents who've got autism. Can you tell us a bit more about that program?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something which myself and my colleague, Professor Sonia Girdler, and our PhD student, Mr. Matthew Jones, we've worked really hard in collaboration with Curtin University's engineering department and the Faculty of Health Sciences. And I suppose really where this kind of comes from, we're very lucky. We developed something called the Autism Academy for Software Quality Assurance, or ASQA, as that's otherwise known. And really, this was a kind of a program which was designed to tap the talents of autistic individuals. Mm-hmm. And what we sort of thought would be really useful and beneficial to the autistic community was developing programs which taps that focused interest, that interest around technology, around pathways into employment. And a kind of a part of that program was developing something called the Coder Dojo. And the Coder Dojo is a computer coding club based at Curtin University, and that provides a free service to autistic adolescents. We run the club every Saturday morning during the school year, and Curtin University staff members, volunteers, parents, and other volunteers actually provide support for autistic adolescents to come in and develop not just computer skills, but also around skills around development of identity, a development of socialization. So when we talk about, you know, tapping the talent, tapping that interest, it's using that focused interest around technology, around computers, to actually develop other skills. And we're really lucky we have computer science and occupational therapy students who actually coordinate the club and its activities. The program is actually now just spread out to places such as Mandurah and Kalgoorlie. And certainly, I think something that's really important to think about is that, you know, a recent survey of autistic individuals and experts in that area revealed that 92% of experts perceive that people with ASD or autistic individuals have specific strengths and abilities. And these strengths and abilities, they include things like attention to detail, you know, a strong sense of morality, trustworthiness, loyalty, and memory. All of these traits lend themselves to employment pathways, opportunities for employment in that kind of technological space or workplace. And certainly we know that in addition to those kind of common attributes, you know, thinking around visual perceptual skills, mathematical abilities, memory, attention to detail, these are really well suited to tasks in the information and communication technology industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's just so fabulous when I came across the article, and actually I've seen some others in the last year or so and spoken to people about autism and where it's at these days and working with individuals with that particular condition, that it's moved away from focusing so much on the deficits and looking a lot more at strengths of these people, of this group.
That's right. And the publication, which I think you might have initially saw the media release for, which was published by our PhD student, Matthew Jones, the actual title of that is like looking at identifying the essential components of strengths-based technology club for adolescents with autism spectrum disorder. And we found that there was a number of ingredients which, rather than focusing, as you quite rightly said, Kat, around the deficit, it's actually starting to think about, well, with these ingredients, how do we kind of set up these programs? How do we kind of go forward? So very much thinking about acceptance of autism, and the adolescents in our program, they're not defined by their diagnosis, but by their personalities and their strengths. And certainly the program, while autism is not a focus. It's about making allowances in relation to our students, our participants' needs and their preferences, and also with a culture of no pressure to complete those activities. Another big thing I think that's important, and I think, yeah, it's not just about these coding classes, but if we're talking about employment and we're talking about, you know, supporting autistic individuals into the workplace, what we found was actually recruiting our volunteers and facilitators and giving them training or them coming already with experience of working with autistic individuals or working with people who may experience neurodevelopmental conditions. And I think another thing that's really important when we're thinking about strengths is matching people that actually have the same either expertise or interest in that area. So a good example, you know, if you're a volunteer, if you're somebody who was kind of volunteering for a program and you've told us that you've got a specific interest in Minecraft or in playing a computer game, let's say Destiny maybe, then matching that adolescent, that young person, that autistic adolescent, with that person with the same interest, and that really does lead to successful outcomes because you've got that shared interest. And I suppose a big thing as well for us is about also that we really kind of worked hard to educate the facilitators of our program about using a very individualized, flexible and collaborative approach in actually sort of teaching these strategies for engaging with autistic adolescents. And I think kind of tying into that, you know, the little things that we can do, and often in our kind of immediate physical environment, the things that we can sort of change in that environment, which helps people to come along, to feel prepared. So using things like visual prompts or visual material, outlining like the available activities, by actually inviting the autistic adolescent, the individual and their families along to look at the program, to actually see the physical layout, to see the physical environment prior to actually enrolling.
The other thing with this particular sector of people is that when they're actually doing those things that they really like, then they're learning at a different level on how they can better connect with their emotions and how they're communicating. Is that right?
Well, certainly in education and within kind of disability services, we often talk about a person-centered approach. And person-centeredness is very much about placing the person before the disability. And I think I already mentioned that we've really tried to work hard to create a no-pressure environment, that people are coming along with their own volition, their own interests, and those interests are driving the attendance. Those interests are driving the types of programs or actual technology that they're actually learning. Again, I think you cannot underestimate the power of setting the environment up in a way that is supportive to enabling people to attend. So I mentioned, you know, that certainly the facilitators of the program having that prior experience, and we actually also have facilitators who are also autistic themselves, and we talk about, you know, the power of that lived experience. So having that lived experience of being able to relate to that person because you've had that experience. And again, not just about that lived experience, having that technological experience. Now, you know, I'm probably not the best person to be able to do computer coding. So asking me about how I might use JavaScript, I'm not that person. But if you've got that interest and connecting that person in the group around that particular interest, it really makes for a more successful relationship. The impact of parents as well, and you know, a lot of the parents of the program are really can do, and that collaboration and building that environment to be conducive, to be make people feel safe and welcome around that. And then certainly, you know, not just about supporting the adolescents, but also that the parents are provided opportunities for training to be able to support their child, not just in that immediate environment, but then going on to school and then hopefully going into employment and the workplace.
So just with regard to statistics, did you say that as of 2015, 1 in 50 people in Australia are now clinically diagnosed autistic, but these numbers are increasing, is that right?
They are, yeah. It's really interesting you say that, Kate, because I was actually at a talk this morning that was talking about some of the recent statistics, and there's a recent report by the Autism Alliance. Certainly, there's been an improved recognition of autism and how it's actually diagnosed through the Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5. You have also seen a reclassification of Asperger's syndrome. And because of this improved recognition and this reclassification, according to this report, it's talking about that almost a 217% increase of people diagnosed with autism in Australia over the last decade. So just a huge increase. In 2018, the Australian Bureau of Statistics reported that about 1.3% of males, or 0.4% of females, 3.2% of children aged 5 to 14 have an autism diagnosis. But actually, the prevalence in the community is likely to be higher, as there are many adults who have not been diagnosed. Again, just something to kind of, and again, this comes from a recent Autism Alliance report. They're saying that in the context of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, over 31% of participants in the National Disability Insurance Scheme have a primary diagnosis of autism. So again, I think that really does kind of tell quite a lot about that we are seeing more people being diagnosed. There is a huge need around that. And something else I think to kind of consider is very much about that. I think certainly 1 in 150, I think we are going to see that actually grow. We're going to see a lot more people being diagnosed.
Wow, most incredible figures. What would you be saying to people who are working, say, with someone who has been identified as having autism? Because you say that there is still a bit of stigma in Australia, is that right?
I think we're, if you look at where we were, I think in comparison to perhaps 10 years ago, I think things are getting better. But I would say that we need to break down the stigmas and barriers. If you look at education, employment, mental health, life expectancy, social or community life, autistic individuals have consistently have among the worst outcomes compared to other disability or vulnerable population groups. And again, this comes from Autism Alliance. Certainly, we need to kind of be thinking about how we can support, enable, empower autistic individuals to feel that they do have representation. They feel that they have people, that they have real voice and opportunity to kind of be included. So I think, yeah, we need to be doing a lot more. We've used something called Photo Voice, which we asked autistic individuals in the Australian community to go out and take pictures about what is important to them around their quality of life. So again, in breaking down these stigmas and barriers, we need to look at new ways, novel ways of helping autistic individuals talk about what is important and express about what is important for them.
Yes, and so, yeah, that's the big shift, isn't it, that it's moved to about autism identity and about who they are first as a person.
And your listeners might be interested in having a watch of a really fantastic YouTube video by Dr. Jack Den Houting, who did a TED talk about neurodiversity and autism. Certainly, neurodiversity and that movement, it is about seeing, it's almost rejecting a medicalized or negative way of thinking about autism, not seeing it as a disorder or a deficit, but it's actually about celebrating diversity. It's about celebrating difference. And it actually comes, the term neurodiversity, it comes from an Australian sociologist, Judy Singer, and a journalist, Harvey Bloom. And what you were saying about the nothing about us without us, that expression was really widely used in, particularly in the United Kingdom, in the 1980s and 1990s, where you had a real change in how disability was kind of understood and conceptualized. So there was a movement from what perhaps has been a traditional medical lens of understanding disability, and in the UK we moved to a more social model of disability. And the social model of disability talks about, it's not my impairments that disables me, but it's actually the way that the physical, the institutional, the cultural environment actually creates barriers. So what you were saying about stigmas and attitude, that really feeds into how people may become marginalized and discriminated against.
Well, look, I mean, it's, if I think about it, it's not a world that I know too much about. So I'm really grateful for you to come onto the show and to explain a bit more for all of us about this. When I think about it, I think it feels to me like we've come a long way, actually, with the way that we're talking about disability. I mean, I guess I'm going back further, probably 20 years, but really there's been quite big shifts. So, do you agree?
I think there is, and when we talk about disability, I think it's really to be mindful that, you know, there's such a wide range of terminology around disability.
Yes.
You know, we talk about mental health, and I think we have, you know, again, mental health, we have a lot more awareness about. Mental health is more prominent in our kind of understanding. People are talking more about mental health, but if we're talking about, say, autistic individuals and mental health, you know, there's still a lot to be done. How we understand mental health from an autistic perspective, how we actually understand autistic burnout. We know that autistic individuals, you know, will often have to use masking strategies in kind of typical situations, which leads to burnout, which has a negative impact on mental health. I think a big thing as well, in terms of, you know, we've come a long way, that I can't emphasize enough in research, in policy design, in designing interventions, we talk a lot about co-production, and I'm very, very honoured to work with one of my colleagues, Dr. Wen Lawson, who is an autistic individual, who we've been very lucky to work alongside Wen. And when we talk about co-production, it just comes back to that nothing about us without us, but you are in any, I think, disability research, any kind of policy, but you're including people with that lived experience from the outset. And it's not just tokenistic, that you're making sure that, you know, when you take on feedback or you take your findings back to the group, you may not like what that individual, what that group are saying, and you have to take that on board and take on board those changes. So I think, you know, yes, in comparison to 20 years ago, there have been changes, but there's still a lot more to work towards. You know, I think I shared with you, Kate, I'm a parent of an 8-year-old child, my son. He's autistic, and I do worry about the future and what that future looks like. And it's certainly, I think, from research and policy, that we are really kind of pushing to get the best outcomes for autistic individuals going forward, that they have as much opportunity for inclusion and participation in Australian society.
Well, it's just absolutely fabulous to hear you talking about what you're doing. You just sound so absolutely passionate about it, Ben. So it's, once again, thank you so much. I've got to wind up our interview now. I was going to sort of, maybe if I can throw a last question to you, or if you wanted to say something else that I haven't asked you, but I was just going to say that all of these things are on a spectrum too, aren't they? So, I mean, you know, it's a big area, autism, isn't it? I mean, in terms of, I mean, it really, there's so much more we could talk about.
Oh, absolutely. Like, it really is a spectrum. And I think the sad thing is, you know, and as a parent gone through this, you go through that whole diagnosis process, which is still a really medical way and of looking at the person. That, you know, you get that report. And I remember the day we got that report, and you feel like that you know, the rug's really been pulled from under your feet, because you read the report, all it talks about is what's wrong. All it talks about is you know, the deficit. And, you know, knowing my son and seeing him develop over the last, you know, 5 years, he has so many strengths, and there's so many opportunities to engage those strengths. And the very notion of that it is a spectrum. And I think, yes, there might be some commonalities, but this is where we have to come back to that person-centered approach, and we have to kind of tap into those unique strengths, those unique interests. I think I shared with you last time, my son, he has a real focused interest on Lego, and it was his birthday this weekend, and we bought him a Lego kit. He's 8, he's building 16-year-old Lego sets, and you know, we've got 24 bags of Lego laid over our dining room table at the moment. But that's his interest, and we encourage that, and we foster that, and we use that as a way to help him, and use it as a way to actually involve him in other activities or interests.
Oh, it's fabulous. Well, look, once again, thank you so much for coming on the Go Well program today.
And thank you so much, Kate. It's really lovely to speak with you.